what happened last night in Iowa, and might it happen in Nevada? On Insight, political consultant Bill Burton will join us. He was the national press secretary for Barack Obama during his presidential campaign. We'll talk, too, about that phone app that apparently caused the problems at the Iowa caucuses. For the rest of the hour, no politics, though you're going to get more tonight. NPR's coverage of President Trump's State of the Union address starts at 6 p.m. You can hear it live on CAP Radio. We have USA Water Ski's Male Athlete of the Year visiting today. He's also the Disabled Athlete of the Year. He competes on both teams. He's been with us on Insight before, so this will be a fun reunion. And later in the hour, from the San Francisco cast of Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, we're getting an in-studio visit from Harry Potter and Albus Potter. Stand by. I'm Beth Ruyak. That's today on Insight. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Beth Ruyak. The phone app that appears to be the cause of the problems in Iowa is the same app that the Nevada Democratic Party has been planning to use in its caucuses coming up on February 22nd. CAP Radio has confirmed this. We'll talk more about that in a few minutes. Meanwhile, there are still no results from that first contest of this presidential election year. And you may have heard that the Iowa Democratic Party chair says there was a coding system problem. The system had not been hacked. Results, however, are not in. If we get word during this hour, we will, of course, report them to you right away. On the phone is a man who knows the Iowa experience, though not quite this 2020 version. He is political consultant Bill Burton. He was national press secretary for Barack Obama during the first Obama presidential campaign and then became deputy White House press secretary in the Obama administration. Hi, Bill. Thanks for joining us on Insight.
Hi there. How's it going?
Good. So what do you know about what happened in Iowa or what's happening right now?
Well, I know that it was an unmitigated disaster based in untested technology and, you know, failing to put in place a backup system that they should have had. Now, I don't share the same view as many that this is robbing one person or two people of their moment in the sun, because I think once the real results are out, smart campaigns will find a way to maximize their the amount of exposure that they get for their moment. But it certainly is a real embarrassment for the state of Iowa.
What else are we getting from all of this? What's at stake here? Maybe the tradition of caucusing, this phone app that's going to be used at least in Nevada, maybe some of the other additional caucuses coming up. What's some of the bigger picture?
Well, I'd be surprised if they still use this app in Nevada. I know that they're contracted to do so, but I think that given the performance in Iowa, if they do in fact still use it, there will be so many more controls in place. You know, one of the bits of news I read this morning was that the problems with the app were so obvious that the Polk County Democratic chair, that's where Des Moines is in Iowa, the biggest county in the state by far, he, in the week before, said precincts in his county were not going to be using the app. They're just going to phone in their results like they had done every single year. Now, the Democratic Party wasn't set up to receive them, and still it was a disastrous process, but I think the technology is not going to be around in the same form for any more caucuses going forward.
We are seeing that Lee Fang from The Intercept reported that the Iowa Democratic Party spent more than $63,000 to Shadow, which is the name of the company, the name of the app, and the Nevada Democratic Party reportedly paid $58,000 to the same company. What about the idea of technology in caucusing or in primaries, perhaps voting someday? Where are you on this question?
Well, I think that there should be a paper trail wherever the voting takes place or however the mechanisms work. But that doesn't mean we don't need very good public interest technology out there, and the development of it is very important. Now, when you consider that the Iowa Democratic Party spent $63,000 to this company to develop this app, that number is actually phenomenally small when you consider the amount of millions upon millions of dollars that were spent in that state advertising for this election. Let alone the donations that came into the Iowa Democratic Party to get this right. So, you know, when you get a price tag like that, that's $63,000, frankly, you get what you pay for. Like, this seems to me like the sort of thing, it's the most important event that happened in our democracy yesterday. It should be locked tight, solid, the most reliable thing that you could imagine, and it just wasn't.
Is this enough to be the end of the caucus system, at least in Iowa?
Well, you know, in defense of the caucus system, and I've been on a handful of presidential campaigns, ones that have won in Iowa and ones that didn't. And I will say that folks in Iowa take the process very, very seriously. And many of the caucus goers go out and they actually meet the candidates, all of the candidates, once or twice over the course of the process. And there's not really any other states where that happens. Now, I think that the diversity is an issue in the state. Obviously, the technical aspects of how this all went down is a problem. Whether or not a caucus is purely representative of a democracy, like all those things are problems. But in defense of Iowa, Iowans take this process very seriously, and we should have a vetting process in which voters can get up close and personal with candidates and really take the time to get to know them and get to tell the rest of the country about them.
The phone app wasn't the whole story because, as you said, there was this backup hotline that was set up. It was jammed when caucus leaders tried to call in. There were these new paper ballots that apparently weren't all being counted, or they ran out of ballots in some places. And there were still stories about coin tosses, which is some of the old-fashioned way. So there is a lot to be unraveled here beyond the phone app, I think.
I think that's right. You know, if nothing else, it sounds to me, and I was talking to somebody inside the Iowa Democratic Party this morning, it sounds to me like the backup system they had with the hotline just did not have enough phone lines and people on the phone lines to work them in order to make any sort of backup work. Anytime you've got a contingency plan, it has to be ready for the full freight of the problem to manifest itself. And it sounds like this was nowhere close. Now, in Iowa, there's something like 1,700 precincts around the state. That's not that many. Right, to have a phone center that can handle that number of phone calls on the most important night for Iowa politics that happens every 4 years. So it sounds like there's a lot of questions and a lot of problems. I'm confident that folks will take a hard look at it and get the answers right. But for now, it just, what a mess.
I'm talking with Bill Burton. He is communication strategist and a political consultant who served in the Obama administration. So frame this up now for the candidates who most, if not all, have moved on to New Hampshire, the next primary.
Well, it's hard to know exactly who's going to get the biggest bounce out of this. But if you're a candidate that came in fourth or fifth place, it looks like you get to live another day because there's no news cycle that's trying to force you out of the contest, particularly when the results are being cast into some doubt. But I think that if you're Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, I think all those campaigns feel very good moving forward here, and they seem like they're going to have some energy that they can really tap into, and New Hampshire is going to be hopefully more directional in terms of where this contest is going. But this is the first time in a long time that Iowa hasn't winnowed the field that night. I was on Dick Gephardt's campaign in 2004, and you know, he was the favorite going into the Iowa caucus, and it ended up in fourth place, 10.8%. Not that anybody's still counting. But, you know, he dropped out that night, essentially. And we didn't have any of that last night because the results were so in flux. And so I think that New Hampshire is probably going to be a lot more definitional to this race as a result than Iowa has been.
Can you tell me a story or two from the Iowa caucus experience on January 3rd, 2008, and working with then-candidate Barack Obama?
Sure. It's one of my favorite nights in all of politics. I was in Des Moines with then-Senator Obama and the team, and you know, we had the smartest folks in politics working on our team in Iowa. And you know, as the results started rolling in, we had a This was one of the surprises to me about last night, actually, is that the other campaigns didn't have very sophisticated reporting mechanisms themselves that they put out. Even Bernie Sanders only put out 40% of the results. But that night, the Obama campaign had all the results. They were pouring in. I was relaying the information to reporters who were out in the press stands at our event as it was happening. And, you know, every number that was coming in was better and more positive for the campaign. And then finally, the results were in. Senator Obama had won the Iowa caucus, and I remember just standing there sort of numb, thinking, that was it. Senator Obama was going to be president of the United States. And obviously there was a lot between here and there, but to see him come up on stage and say those now famous words, they said this day would never come, it was an awesome experience that the folks in that room and a lot of people around the country won't ever forget.
Hmm. In some of the polls I saw, he was leading. So this wasn't a total surprise, and there were some points in the gap there. I believe John Edwards was in second place, and then Hillary Clinton was in third, correct?
That's right. That's right. So the question that everybody had going into that night wasn't whether or not directionally, whether we weren't ascended or not, because it clearly seemed like we were. The Des Moines Register poll came out and showed that we were on the move. The question, though, was, you know, would the Bradley effect depress white voters for a black candidate for president? And people didn't know. It now seems so obvious that, of course, you know, people were going to embrace Senator Obama. But then there was real uncertainty of whether or not there would be a real drop-off in the polling. And you know, the fact that there wasn't gave us real hope. And it was the reason that we were able to get such a massive bounce in South Carolina, because a lot of African-American voters that were sticking around with Hillary Clinton's campaign saw that Senator Obama could be attractive to white voters, and it broke that race wide open for us. And in a state where we were down by a lot, we were able to win by a tremendous margin with the momentum coming out of Iowa.
Will you explain the Bradley effect a bit and talk about who in the race right now might have the same sort of impact or the same sort of division for the voters in ballots they cast?
Well, the Bradley effect, although I know a lot of Californians are more familiar with this, I wasn't here at the time, but when Mayor Bradley from Los Angeles was running, he oftentimes, and correct me if this isn't your memory of it, but oftentimes his numbers, his actual vote totals were much lower than what polls would say for him, because people may claim that they would vote for him, but not actually do it when push came to shove. And so we weren't sure if that would be the case for President Obama. Now, in this race, you've got, you know, when it started, we had Senator Harris in the race. You had Joaquin Castro in the race. Pete Buttigieg, who's a gay American, is in this race. And then there's still questions of how women perform in electoral politics as a result of, you know, watching what happened with Hillary Clinton when she ran this last time. But, you know, the truth is, watching Democratic politics for the last couple of cycles here, it looks like, you know, the top woman candidate also, what right now is getting a big bounce that is new, that wasn't necessarily there before 2016. But in 2018, there was a rash of women candidates who were able to win because of the enthusiasm that there was for women candidates. But in terms of, you know, Pete Buttigieg is a gay candidate for president of the United States, you know, there are a lot of questions of whether or not folks will sign on to that campaign. But I think that he ran a great race and he showed a lot of strength in Iowa. Whether or not he won, it's not clear. But it looks like his campaign is very strong. And so in Democratic politics anyway, it looks like there is an openness to candidates who aren't just white men.
And I agree with you. The Bradley effect ended up being a theory about whether voters would admit in a poll who they would vote for. In that case, it was more about race. Maybe the modern version isn't about race, but it's about the polarizing effect of President Trump and where voters are in what they say they're going to do and what they really do when it comes down to casting a vote. But I want to turn us in a different direction in terms of California and have you talk to me about the Bloomberg campaign. He's been spending a lot of time in California. You might know that he was up in Sacramento yesterday. Blaring headline across the Sacramento Bee today is that he says he's going to take California. What about Iowa? What happened last night and how the Bloomberg factor will play into voters who might have cast early ballots? Those early ballots are landing in their mailboxes right now, but might now decide to wait.
Well, this is actually one of the most interesting dynamics about what happened yesterday. because I've long said that the impact of Iowa is going to have an outsized impact in California, in large part because, like you said, we're getting our ballots. Mine still hasn't come in the mail, but I'm sure it'll come today or tomorrow. And the person who wins Iowa was likely going to get a big surge of votes from people who voted very early when they first get their ballots. And I think that would have helped somebody like Bernie Sanders, whose voters are younger, a lot of voters of color who vote later in the process, which means their votes wouldn't be recorded and reported until much later, you know, weeks into the counting of those ballots. But if he were to win Iowa and get a big bounce on Super Tuesday night, that could be very definitional for him in this race. But the fact that there's a muddy result, I think may well end up meaning that Mike Bloomberg did benefit a lot from yesterday, because he's been in California a lot. His ads are up a lot on television, a lot digitally. And I think that there's a swath of Californians who are attracted to the message that he has. But I think that a lot of voters are going to be like me, an undecided Democratic primary voter, and, you know, wait and see how these contests sort of develop before casting a final ballot.
When do you think we're going to get results from Iowa? Do you have any idea?
Well, the Iowa Democratic Party is doing a call with the campaigns within the next half hour or so. And my guess is that on that call, they'll give some idea of when they're going to put the results out. But it's hard for me to imagine that they can't get this done today. I'm all for, the results need to be accurate, first and foremost, so that the process isn't completely undermined altogether. But, I mean, they need to move on this today. And there's no reason that they can't count 1,700 precinct locations in a 24-hour period. And we're at hour 16 since the caucuses started. So, clock's ticking.
So the New Hampshire primary is February 11th, and then on to Nevada. The caucuses are planned for February 22nd. Would you tell Nevada to scrap that phone app system right now?
I would say get in some of the smartest people in the party to take a hard look at the technology and make sure that it's ready to go. I'm very suspect of software that costs $50,000, $60,000 being in charge of something that's so crucially important to our democracy. Like, there's nothing more important than this primary process right now. And so they need to spend at least as much as they paid for that technology to make sure that it is fully operational and working, you know, in a way that people can be confident about its results.
I think we'll have part two of this conversation, Bill, when we know who's coming out on top of these primaries, because it might be early to talk about the convention, even though you might have had very clear ideas a few weeks ago. So can we do this again sometime soon?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we're headed towards a contested convention, so I'd be happy to talk about it.
Well, let me ask you, a four-way race, a three-way, what do you think?
I think there's a decent chance that it's at least three folks make it all the way to the convention, but it could be four. You've got a lot of candidates who have a lot of money, who have very strong supporters, and who are excited about, you know, who the right person is to take on President Trump. It's hard for me to imagine a scenario where the Democratic Party comes out of a contested convention stronger, because people will be so angry, and we'll just have to see. It's a scary thing to consider, but I think, unfortunately, quite possible.
Thank you so much, Mr. Burton. I'm glad to have your time today. I appreciate it.
Thank you. I'll talk to you soon.
Okay. That is Bill Burton. He is a political consultant and communication strategist. He was Deputy White House Press Secretary in President Obama's administration. You can find continuing news about the Iowa caucuses at capradio.org/insight. And you can hear President Trump's State of the Union message tonight. NPR's special coverage starts at 6 p.m. in the West. Up next, the Sacramento water skier who won both the National Male Athlete of the Year and Disabled Male Athlete of the Year awards. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station, Cap Radio. Thank you. Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak. USA Water Ski and Wake Sports is based in Florida with clubs all across the country. There are competitions all over the world and affiliations that include the International Water Ski and Wakeboard Federation and the U.S. Olympic Committee. And as the website says, this is the organization for water skiing and wakeboarding in the United States. And now, for the first time ever, its Male Athlete of the Year is a seated disabled athlete who's also the Male Disabled Skier of the Year and a member of the Team of the Year. And we know him. He's Connor Pagetto from Sacramento. He's been with us on Insight a few times before, and now he's back with many, many honors. Hi, Connor.
Hi, how are you?
Congratulations.
Thank you very much. It's been a crazy summer, that's for sure.
Yeah, you must have had quite a year. What came together this year?
I think it was the plan that my coaches put together. We've been working on goals for a while. I've got to credit them to a lot of things. Matt Oberholtz and Brian Detrick have been able to put a system together that we communicated about. I said what my goal was. They make the plan, and we work all summer to execute that and make sure we can get the ultimate goal and hopefully keep the U.S. on top and bring home some medals at the same time.
How old were you when you started water skiing?
So I learned how to water ski when I was 6 years old, and then I've been doing it competitively since 2011. So.
And you are how old now?
23.
Okay. Did you finish college? You were in college last time.
I did a couple years of college and then started working full time instead. So.
Will you explain how you compete and the arenas of competition for you are, if I remember right, you taught me this, jump, slalom, and tricks?
Correct.
So literally what you sit in, how you ski, will you give a visual?
Each event has its own modified seat for myself. Some use the same cage, is what the seat is called, for every event. Personally, I've found that it's easier and I have a better fit for each event. So each event has a different modified seat that's mounted onto a different ski for each event as well. For trick, I use a standard hyperlite wakeboard. For slalom, it's a slalom ski custom designed from Liquid Access. And then my jump ski is one of three in the world designed by Brent Dory a while back. So,
you were diagnosed with your disability at age 4, but it's probably something you were born with, correct?
Correct.
It is hereditary. Will you explain what it is and what it does to your muscles or your legs in particular?
Yeah, so I have hereditary spastic paraplegia, which means my brain does not know how to use muscles from my hips down, and I'm slowly becoming paralyzed. So it can happen any second. So like right now I can move my legs a little bit, but that might not be the case in 30, 45 seconds. It comes and goes. The best way to describe it is kind of like running out of gas in your car. So sometimes the signal gets all the way to your legs. Sometimes it kind of just dies off somewhere in your spinal cord.
How's it progressing? What's changing in your body?
For me right now, it's pretty neutral. I've stayed some movement, but it does come and go. I haven't been paralyzed for a long period of time, any time recently. A few years ago, I was paralyzed for 3 months once, and then one morning I fell getting out of bed. And my legs moved and everything. It was kind of weird. But as of right now, more recently, it kind of just comes and goes a little bit there. And
do you take any medication?
I have a baclofen pump, which feeds baclofen, which is a muscle relaxer, into my spinal cord. So then instead of taking it orally and having it affect your whole body and go into your bloodstream, this just affects the nerves that are targeted.
And do you have to do any special physical therapy to keep your limbs moving?
No, for me, it's not necessarily any physical therapy. I used to do physical therapy all the time with my legs, and then I just kind of stopped. Mainly, the only time I'm in for physical therapy is something going on with my upper body, so a shoulder surgery or anything like that.
I have watched your victories, your career over the years, so many competitions, events all over the world, world championships, record setting, and going on these parallel tracks of the disabled athlete competitions, and I don't know the correct phrase. Will you help me? Able-bodied is a phrase that was, is that appropriate?
Oh, of course, yeah.
Okay.
We call them ABs.
ABs, all right. So tell me about competing in both and what this means to have been chosen athlete of the year in both categories for the first time.
So for me, it was a huge honor. It really sets down to all of the hard work that has been put in. It's not like I'm skiing half as much as all the able-bodied guys or girls are. I'm skiing just as much, putting just as much effort and work into it. So being able to be recognized at that level is huge, especially because there were a lot of elite skiers that could have been chosen for the Male Athlete of the Year. So it's a huge honor in that aspect for me.
Has it put you in a category of role model, mentorship? Do other disabled and able-bodied skiers reach out to you? I think you've come up to really the top of this world right now.
Yeah, I would say I take pride in being that mentor type atmosphere and have that kind of reach out. Anybody can contact me. I get messages through Instagram and Facebook and stuff all the time. I do whatever I can to help grow that sport because the ultimate goal is to obviously grow disabled water skiing and wakeboarding. The more people that know about it, the better. And if I'm at the store or something and I see somebody who's like missing an arm or sitting down, like I'll always go up, hey, here's my card. This is what I do. Have you ever thought about being on the water? A lot of the stuff that we do with some of the vets programs, it's huge because a lot of them, they kind of think, okay, my life is kind of over now that I've been blown up or I'm missing something. And so when they see that, hey, there's still a life outside of being a crazy Marine or Navy SEAL or anything like that, they have that competitive drive comes back and all of those things. So that makes all the time and all the energy that's put in on the water that much better because it gives that fire back.
When you say the word crazy, because I know you mean crazy dedicated, crazy intense. You mean it in a way that I know has driven you over many years.
Of course, yeah. I think you have to be a little bit nuts like to do some of the stuff that we do. And for example, like jump skiing, like we're hitting the ramp high in 50 miles an hour, 60 miles an hour. So like it's not necessarily like the easiest thing in the world, but you got to have something. It's either that competitive drive that's just keep pushing you to set records or just be the best you can be, or it's, hey, I've got maybe a little something missing, but I love the adrenaline. I love that rush because of the high risk and reward factor of it.
I believe you're a world record holder in tricks, aren't you?
Correct.
So what do you do? What's the trick?
For tricks, so we have 20 seconds to do as many tricks as we can. So you have 20 seconds down the lake, 20 seconds back, and you have to be perfect because their judges are going to take everything away. So instead of doing, if you're doing like a 180, it has to be exactly 180. If you under rotate or over rotate, they'll take the trick away. So I think that's part of what drives me so much to enjoy trick. It has to be perfect. There's a right and a wrong. It's not like, oh, it's close enough. Here you go. It's either you've done it or you haven't.
You're turning and flipping.
So no flipping, but more spins. Yeah.
All right. I'm talking with Connor Pagetto, a disabled water skier who is the 2019 USA Water Ski Male Athlete of the Year and the 2019 USA Water Ski Male Disabled Skier of the Year. You started all this on snow, and
Correct.
Your parents put you in some special training, I think, when you were six?
Yeah, I started snow skiing when I was about six or so, and that was something we always did as a family. Everybody was snow skiers. So with that, we skied a lot, and I got frostbite in 2010, 2011, and that's when I kind of said, okay, I'm not doing the cold anymore, like, because I can't feel cold in my legs. So I can feel like an ice cube, but if it's cold air or cold water, I can't really tell. So that was the biggest thing. I said, I'm going to this summer, like that's going to warm weather.
And now that you're at the elite level of the sport, what's possible? Is water skiing and wakeboarding in the Paralympics yet?
So it's not because there's a boat involved. Now, if they could figure something out where there's no kind of variable air, then possibly, but cable has a higher possibility of going into the Olympics or Paralympics. But as of right now, it's just the World Championships as high as you can go.
And there's no demonstration arena for the Olympic team either?
Correct, no.
Okay. Where do you want to go with this then? And what's the age range for how long you might be able to compete?
So for me, I've wanted to do this as long as I can. There's a lot of members of the team who are in their 40s or 50s as well. For me, I've been skiing for a very long time. So I've already had a wrist surgery. I've had a shoulder surgery. So I want to maximize my time on the water for sure, because skiing is not always going to be an option. And so as long as I can continue to push the sport and improve and drive somebody else to maybe take it to the next level as well, that's what I want to do.
Say something about how independent and mobile you are in your daily life. You drove here today.
Yep.
You came in a wheelchair. Mm-hmm. How much freedom do you have to do what you want to do?
I can pretty much do anything I need to. Now, if I'm going up a flight of stairs, it's going to take a little bit longer than you, but I can definitely
get up. You will get out of the chair and work yourself up the stairway.
Exactly, yeah. And then for driving and anything like that, like I drive a bigger diesel truck, tow boats, do everything. So like that's my day-to-day life is no different than anybody else's. I guess they wouldn't be towing all the time, but that's going to be the difference there.
Is there science working on the neurology of the disease? And I think the last time you were here, you said only a small number of people in the country have this.
Correct. Yeah. So it's very rare to show signs as a child. So when I was diagnosed, I was the 16th kid in the United States. So there are similarities with MS and ALS and things, but my disability is on 16 different chromosomes. So that's where the gapping is. So there are things that are kind of working in the works, but for the most part, it's still kind of unknown.
Say the name of it again in case someone is now intrigued and wants to research
more. My disability is hereditary spastic paraplegia.
All right. And I'm always curious about what these accomplishments mean to you and for you, beyond it being a sport that you love and a place where you can just physically feel a sense of freedom that maybe you don't get in your everyday life. What else is it?
I think it's that kind of role model type atmosphere, and then the drive to always keep going and the drive to keep pursuing. My brother and I were raised to like never settle. Mom's whole thing was always, hey, you can always do better. You can always keep improving. So the second you are satisfied, then one, you stop learning, and two, you stop having that drive to do anything. So you always need to continue to keep pushing yourself. And I think that's the biggest thing. And I think my coaches are tried and true to that as well. It's always very pushed, but it's directed to having the overall best outcome possible for us and then also the U.S. team.
One more thing before you go. You have some great teammates, and this has been a team honor. So do you want to mention a few other names?
Yeah, so Matt Oberholtz would be a huge one. My mom, Diana Pagetto, my brother has always been there, Gavin, and then Brian Detrick and Steve Detrick, who have been there from the very beginning as well. It's been a huge, huge help. So I love that they push me so hard during the training season that when we get to a world championships or anything, it's not a huge shock, and it makes it a lot easier to compete at that high level.
Well, congratulations again.
Thank you.
It's been so fun to watch this evolve for you and to cheer you on. So I look forward to the next time, too.
Thank you. Thank you.
That is Connor Pagetto, world champion water skier and USA Water Ski's Male Athlete of the Year and Male Disabled Athlete of the Year. Go to the website. We have pictures. We've had some video in past interviews of Connor in competition. You can find that at capradio.org/insight. Good luck in 2020.
Thank you.
Up next, a visit from Harry Potter and Albus Potter. You can see them on stage in San Francisco, and we'll have details coming up. You're listening to Insight on CAP Radio. This is Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruyak, and that is music from Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, a production now on stage at the Curran Theater in San Francisco. This is the fourth production of this play, but one of only two locations in the United States where you can see it, the other being New York. And because the show is so complex, it will not be touring. So right now, San Francisco and New York are your options. In the studio with me, I'm really excited to have Albus Potter here, played by Benjamin Papik. Hi, Benjamin.
Hi.
Glad to have you here. And Harry Potter is here, too, played by John Skelly.
Hello.
Hi, John.
Hi.
In the world of Harry Potter that many of us know from the books, where does this story in the play take place?
So this story takes place basically exactly where the last book left off. If you remember, there's an epilogue, and it's 19 years after the Battle of Hogwarts, and Harry, Ron and Hermione and Ginny are seeing their kids off to Hogwarts. And so that's where we pick up the play 19 years later. Harry and Ginny are showing their son Albus off to his first year in Hogwarts. And then we, then the adventure happens.
You have a son. Let's stop right there.
Yes.
So life has really happened. Harry Potter has a young boy.
Harry's got three kids.
Okay.
James is his first son. He's already a third year, I think, something like that. And then I should know. It's like when your dad forgets your birthday.
Yeah, exactly.
And then Albus is his second child, and then Lily, his daughter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So they have three kids. And Harry finds that life after Hogwarts is maybe a little more complicated than he might have expected.
Hmm. And for Albus, having Harry Potter as a father might be a little more complicated than he expected.
Yeah, and we explore that in the play. Albus finds that living in the shadow of the Harry Potter ends up putting pretty much impossible expectations on him. And something else that we explore in the story, which is I think really lovely. You know, Hogwarts is this magical, amazing place, and as a reader of the books, like, I always thought it would be amazing to go there. But school isn't actually a great place for everybody growing up. And when Albus goes to Hogwarts, he has a really hard time. And it shows you a different side, like what it can be like to struggle at school. And especially if you're struggling at school and your dad is such a famous hero, that's a hard place to be as a kid.
Isn't that something that these stories, these books did really well, was kind of lift up the difficulties, the challenge, the peer issues, the school issues, the authority questions, mm-hmm. and put them in a sort of magical world where maybe we had strategies or coping abilities that we couldn't find within ourselves? What do you think, John?
Yeah, I think what makes these stories so enduring and endearing is that, as much as they're about wizards and magic, they're about real people struggling with real issues. And Harry, as much as he is the hero of the wizarding world, he also, he dealt a lot with guilt in the books and with feelings of inadequacy, and he's still reeling and dealing with those questions. And Albus has inherited a lot of those traits and is dealing with his own issues. And so the play itself is incredibly magical. We do all kinds of magic tricks on stage. It will blow your mind. Mm-hmm. And it will also hopefully make you feel and think as well.
I don't remember who said this to me in rehearsals, but I remember the quote, and it was, "The Harry Potter stories are just like the world we walk through every day. All you do is add magic." Maybe that came from Nicholas Padani, who plays Albus in New York right now. I'm not sure. But I just thought that quote was a great way to look at it. We take characters that you know and love. I mean, when you come to see the show as an audience member, you've got seven stories that you lived through with Harry, both in book form and in movie form for mm-hmm. a lot of people. And then you see someone you love make mistakes with their children and with their loved ones. And it gives us permission as audience members to acknowledge that we make mistakes with the loved ones in our lives and that we can overcome those. It provides catharsis. Mm-hmm. It provides catharsis for the audience when they come. And just adding that one step of magic lets our imaginations flow into the story in a really liberating way.
I want to talk about the fact that everybody thinks of Harry Potter as Daniel Radcliffe, mm-hmm. but you just said the word magic. So let's go there first. Did you have to go to magic school? Did you learn true magic tricks for the show?
Yeah. I mean, well, I will say we started rehearsals at the end of July, and we then rehearsed for about 8 weeks in Berkeley. Then we rehearsed for another 4 weeks in San Francisco in the theater with technical rehearsals. And then we did another 4 or 5 weeks of preview performances where we would perform the show in the evening and then rehearse during the day. So that all told was about 4 months of rehearsal to get us to opening night mm-hmm. of the show. And a lot of that time is spent with all of the technical aspects, because it is so technically complex. And a lot of that is spending time learning magic. And all of us had to, you know, the first day of rehearsal, we had an intro to magic class where we sort of learned how to do a little coin trick. And so that was, you know, they gave us something that we can do at home for our, you know, our cousins or our nieces and nephews. And now, of course, we're doing huge, big magic tricks every day. And
yeah, we perform illusions 5 days a week. We're doing illusions every single show.
I wish I'd have known. I'd have brought a quarter and watched that coin trick right here. But what's your favorite? You each must have a moment that is literally and figuratively so magical.
Well, I don't want to give too much away, but there is one moment where characters transform into other characters.
Of course, that has to be part of the story, right? Yeah.
If you remember in the books, there's Polyjuice Potion.
Yes.
And so that happens in our story. And what I think is amazing about the play is in the books, of course, it's all imagination. Yep. In the movies, you're seeing a lot of computer-generated graphics. You're able to sort of understand how that's done. With here, it's happening right before your eyes. You're watching somebody transform into somebody else, and my hope, and I think that this is true, and I will say, I saw it in New York, and when I first saw it in New York, I was stunned, stunned by the illusions and what was happening. And there's a point where my stomach felt like it dropped out because I thought, that's impossible. That is impossible.
And we use the invisibility cloak in the show.
Good.
And it's amazing because it's a quick moment in the middle of a much larger, very emotional scene. So I think it kind of happens seamlessly as you go through the story as an audience member. But people use the invisibility cloak, disappear in front of your eyes, and appear somewhere else on the stage. And it happens like that.
That is Benjamin Papik sounding so amazingly excited that he is in this show, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. I'm also here with John Skelly, who is Harry Potter. How do you take on this role after Daniel Radcliffe made it so much his own?
You know, it is a challenge. It is definitely a challenge. I think, of course, people have their idea based on the films and their ideas based on the books. And so, of course, I start with the script and the play, and I also understudied the role of Harry in New York as part of the first year of the Broadway production. So I'm also coming into it with the original actor, Jamie Parker, who played it in London and then in New York. And so I've got a lot of influences, but I think ultimately those are all really great influences to draw from. They're great performances. I love Daniel Radcliffe as Harry, and ultimately, it has to be about, I have to sort of find my own way into the character. And so I try not to think about it too much, I guess, is the long answer, the short answer to a longer question.
I think you have the flip experience, Benjamin, because this is your professional debut.
In theater, yes.
In theater, yes. After television and other film experience. And the character of Albus, though known in the book, isn't as carved out. You have a little more freedom to be the kind of Albus you want to be.
Absolutely. It's almost a brand new character to the stories. And that was something we talked about in the first few rehearsals with our directors was Albus Potter, Scorpius Malfoy, and a couple other characters in the story are new to the audience. And we need to make a statement about who we are the second we show up on stage. So you're right. I get to step into this massive global franchise that connects to millions of people around the world, but I get to do it in almost in a free and safe way. I get to bring my own story to that because it is a brand new character.
Let's explain how this show happens and the options that people have, because it's parts one and part two in the book, and you have to follow that in the play as well. So what can people do here?
Well, yes, the book that was published, Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, is actually just a publication of these scripts. So when you buy it, you're not reading a J.K. Rowling novel. You're reading the play in script form. And it is two separate plays, parts one and part two.
Yeah, and so the audience has an opportunity. They can either spend all day with us
Which happens on the weekends.
Yeah, we're doing Saturdays and Sundays, and at the moment Wednesdays,
you
can see part one and two, and you can get immersed in the world all day, which is an incredible experience. That's the way I first saw it.
I love seeing both parts in the same day.
See part one in the afternoon, go have dinner, have a little break, come back, finish the story, find out what's going to happen next.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I will say part one ends on a bit of a cliffhanger. So you're going to want to come back and see part two. Otherwise, you can see it over a couple of nights. You can see part one on one night and then part two the next night. And I think there are options, too. If you go on the website, harrypottertheplay.com, you can buy tickets even, I think, a week apart if you'd like. So there are options.
This is interesting for you as actors, isn't it? For the cast to do the show just part of the way and then come back the next day and do the other half. But some days you're doing it all in one day.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. That's true. I mean, the energy is different. The experience, rather, is different when we're doing just one show in the evening versus doing both shows in the same day.
Yeah, and, you know, as actors, as theater actors, you're used to doing eight shows a week, which we are doing eight performances. But ultimately, we're doing four shows because we're telling the whole story four times. And that is really a gift because you're always sort of, oh, right, this is a scene happening. So you're living that whole story four times a week, and it's a great experience.
The timing is, if it's all put together, how long is the full play?
I don't think that's an accurate way to look at it because it is two separate plays. It's not like you're sitting there for the entire time. So part one is a 2.5 hour play, which is pretty standard, and you get an intermission in the middle. If you're doing both shows on the same day, well, then you go get a dinner break for, I think it's like 2 hours.
Yeah, a couple hours.
And then you come back in the evening, and it's another 2 hour play, like 2 hour, two and a half hours.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Who is in the cast? Who of the Harry Potter world? Is Hermione?
Hermione
back with us?
Hermione, Ron, Ginny.
You said Scorpius Malfoy, so
Draco.
Draco's in the cast. Basically, anybody who you might want to see, I think. Well, I don't want to. I can't give away too much. Dobby.
Dobby.
Lovely Dobby.
I love Dobby.
I will say there are some surprises. You're going to be surprised at who you see again.
Yeah, there are some favorites that come back in surprising scenes.
Yeah.
All right. Benjamin is the one that grew up fully immersed in these books. And how does this match the world that you created in your imagination?
Oh, what a cool question. So first, my mom taught me to read using Harry Potter and the Cursed Child, and it was Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, pardon me, learns to read at 25. No.
Right.
So she taught me to read on Sorcerer's Stone, and she would do different character voices and everything. So
you have a great mom.
Yeah, she was the best, is the best. Lost my train of thought. What was the question?
Oh, about being in the world and how your imagination was as you were reading it, and then now being an actor in the midst of it.
Okay, so, I mean, the first coolest part is the fact that I get to cast spells 5 days a week. The fact that I get to run around with a wand and make magic happen is mind-blowing. And really, what I get to do on stage exceeds any expectation I could have had as a kid. It was incredible to live in my imagination with these stories. And, you know, I dreamed when I was 6, 7 years old of going to Hogwarts. To actually get to do that as an adult is the job of a lifetime. I am so excited to come to work every day and really grateful that I get to be a part of this story.
Benjamin, I was a lot older than you when I read the books, and I too dreamed of going to Hogwarts and being in the imaginary elevator and having an invisibility cloak. Mm. So what about for you, John? I know the books were a part of your life as well, and living in this world, this experience that you've had, how do you like being Harry?
Well, it is the role of a lifetime. It really is. And I came to the books late. I had seen the movies. And then actually when I got the job as the understudy in New York, I immediately said, I have to go back and read all these books. Mm. And I was so blown away by the stories. Of course, I knew that how popular they were. And everyone said, you haven't read Harry Potter. You got to read Harry Potter. What are you doing? And then when I finally actually did, it was like the world opened up to me, and I went, oh, oh, of course these are amazing. These stories, these characters. And yeah, to get to portray this character every night is, yeah, it's amazing.
All right. As I say goodbye, I'd like to hear a line or two as Benjamin and Harry. Would you mind just giving me a line of dialogue so I can hear your voice?
Oh, interesting. Oh, you want to hear the accents?
Yes, I do.
Oh, okay. What about one of the platform 9 3/4?
Yeah. You say.
What about Slytherin?
Yeah.
Dad, do you think? What if I am? What if I'm put in Slytherin?
And what would be wrong with that?
Slytherin is the house of the snake, of dark magic. It's not the house of brave wizards.
Albus Severus. You were named after two headmasters of Hogwarts, and one of them was a Slytherin. He was probably the bravest man I ever knew.
Oh, I love it. Guys, hold tight right here. I think I'm getting a news break, and so I'm going to say that Harry Potter and the Cursed Child continues through August 2nd at the Curran Theater in San Francisco. So there's a lot of time. John Skelly and Benjamin Papik, thank you so much. I'm in love with the show just through meeting the two of you.
Thank you. Thanks
really
for having us.
I appreciate the joy. I'm going to let everybody here know that the Nevada State Democratic Party Chair William McCurdy II has released a statement, and this is regarding the Iowa caucus. Nevada Dems can confidently say that what happened in the Iowa caucus last night will not happen in Nevada on February 22nd. We will not be employing the same app or vendor used in the Iowa caucus. We had already developed a series of backups and redundant reporting systems, and we are currently evaluating the best path forward. All right, you are current on politics. Tonight, NPR's live coverage of President Trump's State of the Union speech starts at 6 p.m. And if you want to go into the world of magic, you can just go to San Francisco, right?
That's right.
And see Harry Potter and the Cursed Child. We'll post a link with all kinds of show detail. Here's a little music to send you on your way. Thanks for joining us. I'm Beth Ruyak. We're back tomorrow.